Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello there, this is Full Throttle, the motorcycle racing podcast from Eurosport. I'm Greg Haynes, and this is the edition for Monday, the 29th of June, 2020. Michael Guy from Motorcycle News will be joining us shortly as we talk about the worlds of World Superbike, British Superbike, MotoGP, and indeed road racing, and so many things that have happened over the last few weeks, and what we can expect moving forward, both the immediate future, 2020, and a little bit further down the line, with some rider moves having been announced for 2021, and some more expected as well. We'll get into that later in the programme. But first of all, World Superbikes roared back into action with a test alongside some of the MotoGP teams at Misano World Circuit, Marco Simoncelli, on the Adriatic coast of Italy for 2 days last week. They really did, once again, the Superbikes give the MotoGP machines a run for their money. And plenty of optimism now as well as we move closer and closer towards the provisional return of racing on the weekend of the 1st and 2nd of August at Jerez in Spain, which will be closely followed by Portimao in Portugal the weekend after. And both of those events, Jerez in particular, expected to take place in very, very hot conditions indeed. So similar conditions at Misano last week. We caught up with a few of the riders. First of all, the Aruba Ducati pairing. Chas Davis, optimistic about the races ahead.
Obviously, it's been 5 months, basically 5 months without riding. Without riding bikes like this anyway. So there's a lot to get back into the swing of things. It took a little bit of time to get the feeling back, but I think you don't forget, and you just need a little bit of extra time after a long break like this. But no, it's gone reasonably well. I feel like we've worked really hard considering, obviously, it's physically tough spending that much time off the bike, and it's hard to replicate, you know, this kind of load on the body without actually having access to this kind of bike at home. But I think that we've done really well, and we've worked hard, and I felt pretty good on the bike. Surprisingly, felt better than what I thought. So no, it's been interesting. Learned a lot, and yeah, I'm looking forward to building on this in Barcelona in a couple of weeks.
As for the reigning BSB champion Scott Redding, well, it feels like most of us have been putting weight on, doesn't it, through the lockdown. Not so Scott Redding.
The best thing I found here was to actually come back and be with the team again and testing new parts, which I was really surprised how fast the guys turned around new parts for me, which I needed to help me from the race in Phillip Island. And also to test, I lost 5 kilos, and that could be the 0.2 that I improved today. So it was good to test my body after some months off, good to be with the team and find the feeling to be, say, on the limit more and pushing. And it is weird to be back in a racing situation, but I'm very happy again to be again with the Aruba Ducati guys. And, you know, it was fun and good to be back.
So 5 kilos lost then for Scott Redding over this COVID-19 lockdown period. Chas and Scott were not the only two Ducati riders on superbikes at Misano last week. Leon Cameo was there with Barney Racing, Michael Ruben Rinaldi with Go 11, and also Leandro Tati Mercado with Motocorsa. We're yet to see them racing this year because they weren't doing the non-European events. Of course, we lost Qatar, but we didn't see him in Australia. So we'll be looking forward to seeing Mercado from Jerez onwards. Kawasaki were there as well, and they've had a few tests recently. World Championship leader Alex Lowe seems very, very confident, but there's still a long way to go in terms of base setting after the unusual setup that's required in Australia.
I've never had such a long break like everyone else. but it was a good test. Sounds strange, but I'm still learning a lot about the Kawasaki. Obviously, this winter, we didn't get too many laps because of the wet weather. And then, obviously, in the winter, conditions are quite cool. So to ride in such high temperatures, I'm still learning a lot about the bike. The setup we had in Phillip Island, obviously, so it was a bit of a strange track. So we had to get back to more of a base setting. That was what we're trying to achieve at this test, just establishing a base setting for me and the bike. But we had a really good test, lots of laps. I did a full 20-lap race simulation, which was at the hottest part of the day. So that was good good training for me, getting back into it. And, yeah, really positive. Like I said, I've still got a lot to learn and understand about the bike, but really happy with the feeling at the end of the test. And two good days working back with the guys. Obviously, a big effort for them to get everything ready with all the difficulties with the restrictions in place at the minute. So thanks to them, and looking forward to confirming the changes and the setup in Barcelona in a couple of weeks.
And of course, Jonathan Rea, multiple race winner and five-time world champion. What was it like for the Northern Irishman to be back out in action?
It's been very valuable, to be honest. Being so long away from the bike, it was a little bit strange getting up to speed. In fact, I felt like I struggled a little bit in the beginning to feel comfortable. Nothing was coming naturally, but step by step, we worked with the bike. We tried lots of different geometries that we wouldn't normally get to try during a race weekend. And yeah, step by step improved my feeling. But lucky thing is we still have a lot of days testing left. So condition-wise, I felt quite good out there. It was very hot, but that's going to be valuable because the first 3-4 races of the season, I expect, are going to be the same.
And thankfully, Rea escaped a close to 160 km/h crash at turn 12 when he was pushing on with a qualifying tyre on Wednesday.
You know, I hurt my ego a little bit. I ran so fast into, after the fast corner, the next one, there's a little brow on the apex, and I ran over that and didn't want to squeeze the brake so much. So I picked the bike up a little bit and went straight into the gravel. You know, my expectation was there was some runoff there, but it was straight into gravel. So my motocross skills were pretty good in Phillip Island, but definitely ran out of talent today.
Not easy, though, at the moment in terms of travel with quarantines in place all over the place. It means Jonathan Rea can't actually get back to the UK because he'd have to quarantine for 14 days. And that would affect the upcoming test in early July, which I will be attending. So I'll let you know if there's any interesting notes to take out of that one. But just how complex is it at the moment in terms of travel?
Yeah, it's very complex because in the UK now we're under the, like a quarantine, a 14-day quarantine. We have two tests scheduled within that 14 days. So it means I can't return home. So I have my motocross day van. I loaded it up. Pretty much my life's in the van now. And I mean life, I mean with kids and Tars as well. So that's that was cool. We came down to the south of France and we're traveling with my coach Fabian and his family all together. So it's nice, training together. And I spent a few days at his house in the south of France and we made our way over here. And I'll stay here, near the beach and do some motocross, cycling, and pretty much like every year. So looking forward to that. And then looking forward to Montmelo as well.
Well, that's good to hear, isn't it? The riders sounding very optimistic, and who can blame them? It's been a long, long time for many of these riders, probably the longest time ever since they started their racing careers, that they've not actually been on their professional racing motorcycles. Michael Guy with us now, the sports editor from Motorcycle News. It is great, isn't it, Michael? We've waited long enough to have some bikes officially back out in a test.
Really, really good to see, Greg. Yeah, I can't really emphasise that enough. I mean, we've been watching all these guys showing what they've been doing during lockdown, during this pandemic, the training they've been doing, et cetera, et cetera. But, I'm sure like a lot of us, we were getting a little bit bored of seeing these guys on push bikes. That's not why we watch them. We follow them to see them on motorbikes doing, some of the best riders in the world. So to see those guys back out there on track, and, we've had Ducati and Kawasaki, the sort of two real big hitters of world superbikes going head to head after months off.
And how difficult has it been as the sports editor of the weekly MCN newspaper that's been going for 60-odd years? How difficult has it been to actually keep putting a newspaper out there every week for the best part of 3 months now with nothing actually happening on tracks?
It's been an interesting experience, I won't lie. there's been times, I think to start with, you sort of felt like you were kind of sort of staring down in the barrel thinking, I've got space to fill each week and there's not much going on. But what has happened, it's kind of given us the opportunity to sort of do a lot of nostalgia, to look back and to do kind of features that we'd never normally get time for, sort of things that would just be overtaken on the course of a normal season. So in many ways, I've actually sort of enjoyed it. But saying all that, I am absolutely glad that we've got, you know, just over a couple of weeks to wait until MotoGP kicks off, obviously followed by World Superbikes and BSB. So, I mean, to actually get some races back and to be looking forward as opposed to back is always a bonus for a weekly newspaper, as you can appreciate.
Yeah, let's just talk about those schedules then, Michael. How difficult is this going to be? Because I think nobody's imagining this is going to be an easy procedure here, getting these events underway. We don't know whether there's going to be crowds at all of them, or if not any of them. That's very much going to depend, I guess, on what happens, isn't it, now with this coronavirus situation, the COVID-19 scenario?
Yeah, I mean, you know, put racing to the side for one second. You know, everybody's life has been, you know, spectacularly disrupted. You know, obviously some, you know, very tragically. But I think what we're sort of finding out is that no one knows the exact way forwards. We've got all these dates on the calendar, which is fantastic. That's obviously a major step. The testing that's going on in Misano this week obviously will be the first time that these teams have really kind of had to work as they will have to work, you know, in terms of, you know, social distancing protocol and PPE. All these are going to be challenges that they're going to absolutely have to iron out. And they're going to be under the spotlight as well, because there might not be fans there, but the TV cameras are going to be there. So we're going to see how these people are working. So it's going to be a big challenge. I think the only thing we can be sort of rest assured with is the appetite that we all feel to go racing, the appetite we all feel to get this back on the road is so strong that people are just going to do whatever it takes to make it happen. And although there's a big part of what we do and what we like about motorcycling in terms of the spectacle that surrounds it, the bit that actually really matters is that, you know, 20 laps, 40 minutes of racing when the lights go out, that's what we're all really there for. So, and crowds or not, that will ultimately happen. And that's where we are this year. And I think we've just got to kind of embrace that, celebrate that, and then obviously hope long-term things do go back to the norm that we're all used to.
Because commercially, if we take MotoGP as an example first, Dorna's main source of income is, of course, TV rights and the circuit hosting fees. So as long as these events are happening and being televised, there is some revenue there, isn't there? And that's so important for all the sponsors, trackside, the team sponsors as well. Yes, I guess there's going to be a big effect going forward, but it's a hell of a lot better than having no racing this year, isn't it?
Oh, without a doubt. And as we've seen, you know, Dorna have been offering, you know, financial support to some of the teams, and it's going to be help in that way. Sponsors, as you touched on there, Greg, is going to be something that we're going to have to keep an eye on. You know, there's obviously some businesses, I guess, ultimately would have done quite well through this whole sort of pandemic, but the vast majority you would think will have seen, you know, loss in profits, etc. And it comes to a decision as to, you know, if you're failing staff or making staff redundant, can you therefore then justify sponsoring a motorcycle race team?
Yes.
You know, these are obviously, you know, business decisions that, you know, I have decisions I don't have to make, but you could see why there will undoubtedly be some casualties from sponsorship across all the paddocks, I think. I don't think anyone's going to be immune from it, even MotoGP.
Because as a small team, and we've already seen a few teams, haven't we, pulling out in the BSB paddock amongst the junior ranks, and I'm sure the same is probably going to happen in places like the Supersport 300 World Championship, some of those smaller Italian teams, you know, their core business is racing, isn't it? It's not like some of the bigger corporations that are manufacturers anyway, or they're promoting another product. These people make their money by going racing, don't they? So I suppose in some cases, it's easier and more sensible and logical to just delay it for this year and come back in 21.
I think there is something obviously to be said for that. I guess, you know, these people, like you say, if it's their living, if they're looking at the figures and thinking, well, we can't do this and make any living and pay our own mortgage, then, you know, you're not going to do it. I think the only worry is that if you kind of pause a relationship with a sponsor, you know, are they still going to be there 12 months later?
That's
a big question. But, you know, again, these are unprecedented times, and, you know, how the world is going to look in a month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months down the line is kind of not anyone's guess, hopefully not. But you know what I mean? There's a lot of change still very much happening.
So if we quickly go through the different categories, Michael, and you've been covering them all, let's start with the roads. Obviously, the Isle of Man TT is the showpiece event. That was cancelled many, many weeks ago, and pretty much all the other road events have as well. I suppose that's logical, isn't it? These are taking place in the middle of cities or the middle of all around an island in the case of the Isle of Man. The structure and the infrastructure and the planning that has to go in place for that, you can't just move that around by a week or a month or so, can you? I guess you've got to either cancel it or stick to the original date.
Yeah, I mean, the Isle of Man, at the end of the day, you know, it's got a population of about, don't quote me on this exactly, but, you know, about 75,000, I think.
Yeah.
And then you've got another sort of 45,000 fans coming in from all around the world onto the island in the middle of a pandemic.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to be top priority, even if it is a, you know, a big sort of source of income for the island. You know, the Isle of Man have obviously... You know, they've got their own government. They're very proactive in the way they rule, and they're able to. I mean, they shut down. You know, they shut down, and they got the coronavirus very much under control. I don't think they've got any active cases now. I think it is. You know, it's, you know, you can sort of count on one hand, which is obviously a fantastic achievement. And you've also got to remember that, you know, yes, they've got a hospital on the island, but anything sort of serious, anything, you know, a hospital is not big enough to be able to sort of handle any sort of, you know, any sort of pandemic. You know, people would obviously be thrown over to Liverpool with sort of the normal sort of route people would take if they're seriously unwell. So as an island, I just don't think they had the infrastructure to risk it happening. You know, it would be potentially so damaging. But on the flip side, it's one of the longest standing, biggest single standalone sporting events there is, and for it to not run, you know, last time it didn't run was 2001 when we had the sort of mouse outbreak. That's the only other time it's been cancelled in my kind of, you know, sort of working life. So it's a big loss, and it's gonna, you know, and with it being once a year, you know, you've essentially got to wait 2 years from, you know, the 2019 event right the way through to 2021. So yeah, a big loss without a doubt. And the same goes for North West. The Ulster GP was not looking positive at all for actually happening anyway. There is talk about Cookstown happening, which is an Irish road race, and there is also Macau still things to be on the cards in November. But whether we're going to get the riders to go there and compete is sort of a bit kind of up in the air at the moment. So yeah, the road season has been, you know, completely decimated, you know, 100%.
It also seems as though the trade shows have pretty much been completely decimated as well. And talking of November, we would have normally had Motorcycle Live at the Birmingham NEC in November, the Intermote show in Germany a week or so later in November. EICMA in Italy is a very big one, which at the moment is still happening, but I can't imagine that's going to go ahead. Why though now, Michael? Because when they were initially cancelled a few weeks ago, a lot of people were saying at the time, it seems quite early to cancel a show in November. Is that just because of the planning that has to go into it? Did they have to make a decision? Was there a cutoff?
I think it's twofold. I think, okay, I'm no scientist, but you've got to think having, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 people indoors in close proximity is a potential big risk for one. But I think another factor is the fact that because of the effect the pandemic has had, you know, globally across, you know, supply chains and manufacturing, I don't think that the manufacturers will have their range of 2020 bikes to display or 2021 bikes to display as they initially planned. So it's like there's a big show where they could showcase all the stuff they've got, but I think they're going to either not have the bikes to showcase or not be able to fulfill orders. So it's a twofold problem, I think, because I think we are going to see a reduction in the amount of new bikes that are coming through because of just what has happened. You know, the effect of, you know, and the effect is obviously we're feeling it now, but we're going to carry on feeling it, unfortunately. You know, it's going to linger on without a doubt.
Yes, that in turn is leading to further reports now, isn't it, about problems within the manufacturers in terms of redundancies and so on and so forth. I suppose it's to be expected, isn't it? And it's going to happen in so many industries all over the world.
Unfortunately, yes. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I'm speaking to to the people within motorcycle dealers, and the kind of the sort of general feedback we've been getting since dealers have been able to open again at the start of the month was, I don't think they're seeing huge new bike sales. What they are seeing is really, really strong secondhand bike sales. And we think that is kind of people either that they've got a bike, they're kind of a leisure biker, so they might have, they might be lucky enough to have a Panigale in the garage or something, and maybe they commuted by public transport to get to work, and now they're looking at a second bike to get to and from work. Or it's people, returning to biking, they haven't been out for a while, or new bikers. I think the sales of sort of scooters and, small capacity commuter bikes is really strong, which is, that's a small win in the grand scheme of things in terms of the motorcycling industry. But yeah, in terms of new bikes, I think we're going to see a few tough times for the manufacturers, to be honest.
Let's hope it won't be too tough for the actual people competing in some of the championships as well. If we look at Superbikes, first of all, of course, and they'll be live on Eurosport and the Eurosport Player. World Superbikes is set to kick off first. Well, I say kick off, it already has, of course, in Australia back at the end of February on the 1st of March as well, the Sunday there. But we're supposed to resume on the first weekend of August with Jerez, which in turn is straight after those two back-to-back MotoGP race weekends. Sporting news, Michael, in terms of World Superbikes, I guess the biggest story to come out of the last couple of weeks is the fact that Jonathan Rea has now re-signed with the Kawasaki Racing Team for, and we quote, a multi-year deal. We don't know whether it's 1+1, whether it's 2, whether it's 3, whether it's 11 years. We don't know, do we? I don't know whether that's because they don't yet know and they're going to decide as they go, or whether they just don't want to reveal it to the world just yet.
Yeah, it's a good question, actually. I would be intrigued to know. My kind of guess is going to be some sort of rolling deal. It's so clear to see the relationship that Jonathan Rea and Kawasaki have formed with his crew, them as a manufacturer. It's incredibly strong. Winning 5 world championships on the bounce obviously helps quite a lot with the feel-good factor.
They're hardly going to fire him, are they?
Exactly, and Jonathan, he's ridden for other teams. I think he had a good relationship with Tenkate Honda, but ultimately they weren't able to give him the bike. As soon as he got a bike capable of winning, he did what we always believed he could do, and he went out and won. So I think that the relationship is that strong that they're just going to keep on going, and I'm sure the intention is to keep on winning. Personally, I guess maybe it would have been nice to see him swap around, to go to another manufacturer, but I think that's just for our own sort of satisfaction, really, and our own sort of curiosity, rather than, I don't think it would make him, I don't think, we have this sort of question in for other championships, about a rider can only be a great if he's won on different manufacturers, etc. Are you telling me Marc Marquez isn't a great? Are you telling me Mick Doohan isn't a great? It doesn't really wash in my book. Is it good if they can do that? Yeah, absolutely. Jonathan Rea has obviously had spells with Honda. That was one of the rumours, obviously, that Honda could be one of the teams that would be interested in taking him back. When I was working in World Superbikes as a superbike reporter for MCN, there was regular contact from Ducati with Jonathan Rea. Davide Pardozzi was who was managing the World Superbike project at that time, was absolutely a fan and was keen to get him on board. But
I think for Jonathan 2014, they were very close, weren't they, Mike? I think they were particularly close.
Yeah, well, I'd actually finished in World Superbike, but even before that, there was absolutely times when it looked like it could happen, I think Jonathan's talent's always been pretty clear, really, isn't it? And And it's just been borne out since he's been on a winning bike. So, I mean, I think it's, I think the important thing is he's staying in the championship. You know, it could be easy to walk away, couldn't it? You know, he's obviously, and rightly so, made a lot of money and he's had a lot of success. And he's a, you know, he's a popular guy, especially, you know, in Northern Ireland. And, you know, why, you know, he doesn't have anything else to prove, but I think he loves it and he enjoys it. And he's not a kind of rider that sort of shirks from the challenge. And, you know, there's been a lot of hype, obviously, about Scott Redding coming to World Superbikes and, you know, the sort of arrival or the rise of Top Rack. But I think he'll just be relishing these things, you know, because, yeah. You know, because if he can win again and beat these guys, you know, Top Rack's, you've got to say he's destined to go to MotoGP at some point. You know, Scott's obviously a former MotoGP, you know, podium man. You know, by him beating these people, it just adds to the kudos, doesn't it, really? So I don't think he's going to be, I think he's going to be worried, put it that way, by the challenges he's got.
And Jonathan himself was doing an interview I was watching online the other day, and he said he's fueled the fire even more being sat at home for a few weeks because it's actually made him realize how much he loves riding. Not that he wasn't still loving it, but it's made him realize even more how much he loves riding. And why would you want to stop?
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. And we've seen this before, haven't we? We've seen riders who retire at the top. I guess your couple of the most obvious ones are Troy Bailey, Max Biaggi, yeah. You know, and what do? They both came back.
Yes, true.
You know, they sit around for a while, miss possibly a year or two of when they maybe even could have carried on winning, come back. You know, Biaggi got on the podium, didn't he? You know, he'd retired, been out of sport, came back, a couple of wild cards and got on the podium in Sepang, I think it was.
Yes, it was, yeah.
You know, so, you know, incredible that these guys can still do that. But, you know, obviously it's a lot easier if you don't stop. But I guess, like you said, the break that he's had, he's almost maybe had a bit of a taste of what potential retirement could look like, and he doesn't like the look of it.
And with someone like Jonathan Rea as well, he can easily do a Carl Fogarty, and I think he probably will, and stay with Kawasaki as an ambassador, well, probably for the rest of his life. And I think he'll also probably, Michael, be remembering Foggy's switch, admittedly, for more money, but not that much more money, to Honda for 2 years. He broke up a winning team, in his own words, and ended up going back to Ducati and winning two more titles, didn't he?
Yes, yes, yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, it was not the bike to be on then at the time. You know, the RC45 was very quick, but it wasn't the sort of sweet handling all-round package of the Ducati at the time. But no, I mean, I think there's... I guess in a way he's fortunate because he can look at all these sort of scenarios that have played out in front of him. You know, your Baylisses, your Biaggis, your riders that have swapped, yeah. Thinking that the grass is maybe greener or they want to change. But I think the key factor here is that Jonathan is very happy. I think Kawasaki are happy. I don't think he's been undervalued by Kawasaki. You know, I don't think they're underpaying him, for example. I think all that side of things. So, you know, if you can keep that all sweet and you're satisfied, it's like anyone, you know, any whatever job you're in, if you feel valued, if you feel that you're being, you know, paid the sort of the right amount for what you're doing, then you're going to perform well, you're going to deliver and you're going to be motivated. And, you know, and I think Jonathan's the kind of the perfect sort of storm for all that. You know, he's totally motivated, well looked after, great relationship, and on a great motorbike with a manufacturer that don't have any other serious racing commitments apart from sort of BSB and the roads. But, you know, in terms of full factory involvement, in terms of KHT, in terms of, you know, full backing, they're there. Whereas obviously all the other manufacturers in WSB have a sister MotoGP project, a big system MotoGP project, you know, a project that is obviously the number one and Superbike is secondary. So, but that's obviously not the case with Kawasaki. And I think the team and Jonathan sort of reap the rewards of that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people now who, as it often happens when somebody's dominated at times, criticize that person or that team, they're going to be looking back in the future and thinking, crikey, he was good. They really are, aren't they? When you watch back some of these race performances in the future, And we've said it before, haven't we? People said it was boring when Mick Doohan was winning, but look how he's looked back on now as an absolute legend. And I'm convinced the same will be the case with Jonathan Rea in World Superbikes. In terms of British Superbikes, Michael, we've got a 6-round schedule, 3 races per weekend, no showdown. So every point counts now, doesn't it? You're going to have none of this talk that sometimes people said, oh, they're taking it easy, they're going for podium points. None of that anymore. And the first race of the weekend on the Saturday, I think we might get a real selection of winners, actually, because the real smart people who are going for the championship, they're not going to try anything too risky in the first race and risk losing 3 races if they really smash up their bike, are they?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think a DNF is you know, one DNF you might just get away with, but more than that, I think that's going to be kind of serious, you know, a championship assault over to some degrees. And the other thing you've got to remember is that the vast majority of the British Superbike grid will have only ever raced with a showdown.
Yes, that's very true.
They would have, you know, I mean, admittedly, they would have had experience in other championships in their way, British Supersport, etc., British Superstock. But in terms of superbikes, they would not have ever raced without a showdown. So, you know, personally, you know, I think the trouble for me with BSB, you know, purely from sports editor's point of view, MCN and kind of continuing the excitement with BSB, you kind of always had, you know, you're so much anticipation for the first few rounds, you know, to see who's doing what and new bikes and new riders on new bikes and just seeing how the sort of dynamic of all that is going to work. And then there always was that sort of lull period for me where, you know, the big hitters are just, you know, they're going to carry on scoring points. You know, they're going to be in the top 6 come the end of the year. And there's a bit of a flurry to get into those last stages of the showdown. And then the showdown is obviously really exciting. But you ended up with a bit of a sort of a mid-season lull. And there's going to be none of that. And although it is only 6 rounds, all triple headers, like you said, you know, 18 rounds, you know, that to me is still a credible championship, you know.
Absolutely,
I know they're going to be on the same weekends, but, you know, it's going to be more races than MotoGP. So if you look at it like that. So I don't really think it's, I don't think there should be any question mark over the sort of credibility of the championship. And I'm talking about that for MotoGP and WSB. Even if there's not as many rounds as there is normally, I think the circumstances, the racing and how it's going to happen, I think the challenges are going to be different for teams, riders, manufacturers, crew chiefs, personnel, everyone, that whoever does end up with the most points on the board at the end, you know, he's absolutely going to be a deserving world champion. I don't think there should be any kind of asterisk next to their name in the record books, kind of saying, oh, yeah, but that was the year that COVID-19 hit and we only had this many rounds. I think the person that wins and handles the whole situation the best, you know, he's absolutely a completely worthy champion.
I agree completely. It's the same number of races for everybody. Everybody knows the rules they're playing to this season going into the first race. And if you think back to the very early days of Grand Prix racing, 1949, 1950 and so on, you only had 6 or 7 Grand Prix per season anyway. And we still remember those guys as the real legends of the sport, don't we?
Yeah, you wouldn't question their credibility at all, would you? You know what I mean? Wouldn't even cross your mind to. So no, I think that's an important one. And, you know, the crowds are there, some of them, fantastic. If they're not, like I said earlier on, you know, to me, it's about that race. It's about those 40 minutes when the lights go out. That's what really matters.
Greg Haynes here, back in the Eurosport Full Throttle studio. I hope you're enjoying this edition of the podcast so far and the interview with Michael Guy. And please, if you haven't already, subscribe to the Full Throttle podcast from Eurosport. We're available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts. You can also find us through the Eurosport website as well. And we'll be bringing you interviews like the ongoing chat with Michael Guy and also rumours like this one that I've just heard over the last few days. Now, we can't say too much at this point in time, but this is definitely one to keep an eye on over the next few weeks. All I can tell you at this very moment is that I've heard from a good source that one of the riders in World Superbikes currently racing in blue leathers might be trading those in for another colour for 2021. Perhaps the colour of those leathers for 2021 may be white. Let's just see how that one pans out, shall we, over the next few weeks. But in the meantime, it's back to Michael Guy. MotoGP, interesting, very interesting indeed, intriguing stuff. And of course, with no track action having happened at all for MotoGP, they haven't had any racing this year because Qatar was just Moto2 and Moto3, and we were lucky to get that much. MotoGP, it's all been happening off the track, hasn't it? And a big announcement last week, of course, if you're listening to this podcast as it goes out on Monday, just rewinding to last Thursday, the announcement of Danilo Petrucci, who's leaving Ducati to go to KTM, but Tech 3 KTM, the satellite team, Miguel Oliveira will replace Pol Espargaró, who in turn will be Marc Márquez's teammate next year at Repsol Honda. So where do we start there? Because my initial reaction, Michael, is Alex Márquez and Marc Márquez were together. It's a PR dream, the two brothers. They're all over the place here in Spain. They're on adverts on the TV. They're sponsored by a yogurt company. There's cardboard cutouts in supermarkets. They're real national celebrities. But it seems to me as though it's almost as though it was always a plan for Alex Márquez to be there for 1 year because they've replaced him and he hasn't even had a chance to prove himself. Or is that just me thinking too much? I don't know.
Like you say, you don't really know where to start. I mean, you've also got to factor in that during this time, Marc Márquez has signed a 4-year deal with Repsol.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could be very cynical and suggest that Alex Márquez joining Repsol was a lovely little sweetener to get Marc to sign a 4-year deal with Repsol.
Mm.
And when
I know there'll be plenty of people we both know who will think that. You think that is the case, or do you just not know, really? We don't know.
I don't know. I mean, what I do know about racing is that manufacturers, team managers, there's some very, very clever and savvy people, and their objective is to win. And it doesn't really get too much more in depth than that. That is the one mission these guys have.
Yeah.
You know, we see how focused crew chiefs and chief engineers get. You know, they're every bit as competitive and driven as the riders themselves.
Even more sometimes.
Yeah. So, yeah, you work with these characters in World Superbikes. You know, we could obviously name a few quite easily. But I think that they will do whatever it takes. They will do whatever it takes to either start winning or carry on winning, and you know, kind of without being, you know, disrespectful to these people or questioning their judgment, you know, the morals, if you like, can sometimes be questionable in racing. You know, we've seen it throughout racing. You know, if you different championship, and just one that springs to mind, I can remember when Paul Bird dropped Steve Hislop when he was winning on the Monster Mob Ducati. And it was, you know, I just started working at MCN, and there was a huge outcry. You know, there was a real, real bad feeling towards it. Obviously, they signed Shane Byrne, and Shane Byrne carried on winning and did lots and lots of winning. And, you know, and you look back at it and you go, well, it wasn't a bad decision, although at the time it didn't seem particularly kind of morally sound. But they carried on winning, and that is their aim, that is their objective. So it's kind of by any means possible. But sorry, I went right off on a tangent.
It makes sense though. I mean, I was just going to carry on that tangent, and we'll veer off over there, and then we'll come back. But how important do you think it is, Michael, as a fan, as the sports editor of MCN, but a fan deep down, how important do you feel these team bosses care about the public's opinion and the outcry in that particular scenario? Do you think it must affect them to an extent, mustn't it, knowing what people are saying about them, surely?
Honestly, I don't think it does. I think the personalities, the people we're talking about,
yeah,
you know, sometimes are ex-racers. They want to be remembered for winning.
That
is what ultimately they do get remembered for.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
true. Paul Bird will be remembered for Shane Byrne coming in 2003, winning the British Superbike Championship, I'm pretty sure, and doing the double at Doug Brown's Hatch World Superbikes beating Neil Hodgson on a Factory 999. You know, they're the things he will be remembered for ultimately. rather than the fact that he sacked Steve Hislop.
Yes, you know, that,
true. So I don't really think it's I think they're different personalities, and that's why they do what they do, and ultimately that's why the successful ones carry on doing what they're doing and carry on winning.
You have to be very selfish at times, don't you, to succeed in this sport?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And that's something that, you know, that riders will say, and, you know, partners of mechanics that travel all around the world, you know, it becomes an obsession. Absolutely. Yes. Becomes an obsession. But coming back to Pol going to Honda and Alex Marquez leaving or being moved from Repsol, you're right. It's sort of like, where do you start? I mean, starting with Pol, I'm actually really excited to see him on the Honda, personally.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually think that, you know, he's one of the guys. I know his career hasn't carried on the incredible progression of someone like Marc Marquez, but I was talking to a Spanish colleague of mine, Manuel Pacino, and he sent me a picture of Alex and Pol when they were teammates back in the championship on 125, might have even been 80s or something. Mm-hmm. You know, those guys went head-to-head in Moto2. They are, you know, I think Pol is a really determined, really aggressive rider that's not going to get phased by it. I'm not suggesting for one minute that he's going to come in and beat Marc Marquez, because I think that's an incredibly big ask. But I do actually think he's going to be well suited to the bike. And I think that the years he's had, what, 4 years now? It'll be 4 years this year with KTM developing a bike, you know. We've obviously seen over history has shown, you know, that rookies coming in and riding on the Yamaha generally can be very, very competitive. You know, Pol was good. Bradley had some good rides. Cal obviously had some good rides. And then we've obviously seen Zarco, Quartararo, all these guys almost, okay, not all of them came from Moto2, but the ones that did almost seem to be able to make this sort of seamless progression from Moto2 to MotoGP on the Yamaha in particular. But Pol's kind of got more strings to his bow now because he's been on the KTM. It's clearly a difficult motorbike to ride. It's a powerful motorbike, but in terms of the experience KTM has compared with Honda and Yamaha, etc., you know, they're way behind the ball. And he's been part of that development curve, and he's had to grit his teeth and ride around it, which he's shown pretty consistently that he's been able to do. And ultimately, you know, whereas Pol and Bradley were quite evenly matched on the Tech 3 Yamahas, to be fair, you know, Pol definitely seemed to have an edge over Bradley when it came to kind of just sort of grabbing the ball by the horns and really sort of just sort of, you know, sucking it up and getting on with it. And I think that some of that attitude will do very well with Honda, because, you know, speaking to anyone, the Honda is also a difficult motorbike to ride. You know, incredibly good and incredibly strong, but not the easiest bike to kind of exploit those strengths. And I think that Pol potentially will be well suited. So I actually think he'll go well on it.
I think you're right, actually. I agree. I mean, beating Marquez is not going to be easy at all, is it? But also, it's worth remembering, they are former huge rivals, aren't they? Remember that 125cc race at Silverstone, 2010, I think it was. I mean, they did not like each other very much, did they, at that time?
Yeah, so that's also a great sort of dynamic. But what a change in dynamic for Mark, though, from having his brother in the team, you know, his best mate almost, what it seems like, to having someone who you've got some needle with.
But why though, Michael? Why are they replacing Alex Marquez, having not even had a chance to prove himself? He hasn't even had a single race, which makes me think perhaps this was always going to happen anyway.
Yeah, you're now starting the conspiracy theories now, Greg.
I mean, I could be completely wrong. It's just my inkling, really. I don't know, but
it's a weird situation, isn't it? It's hard to kind of explain the sort of process that went through there, unless it was a plan from the word go.
Maybe, you know, if Alex Marquez had gone out there and won 4 Grand Prix, which I don't think would have happened, but if he had, you have to think they probably would have kept him. Maybe he's just drawn the short straw and they've realised Pol Espargaró is available, and it's just, unfortunately, they're not going to have to, you know, they can't get rid of Marc Marquez, can they?
No, exactly. And I mean, and I think in many ways, I think in an ideal world, for 2020, Alex probably would have arrived and gone to LCR.
Yeah.
You know, in the first place, rather than come into such a high-profile team as the Repsol Honda team. You know, if he'd have gone into LCR as a second rider, like Nakagami did, when Nakagami came into LCR with Cal clearly as a number one rider, there's like very little expectation, there's very little pressure on them. And that's, in another world where I was a MotoGP rider, that's how you'd want to arrive, really. You know, if you come in from Moto2, you want to come into a team and not be under the spotlights to some degree and kind of learn your craft and get on with it. But it's strange. I can't really think of too many scenarios where similar things have happened. I hope I don't get this wrong. I think James Hayden missed out on, he never actually started the BSD season in for GSC Ducati. I think that was when Livia came in. Livia became available and right. James was dropped for Gregorio. And that obviously went on to be a huge success. Went on to win the British Championship. This is comes back to the conversation earlier team managers making tough decisions. So it is an interesting one. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. Alex is going to have to be pretty mentally strong to have had to deal with that. I hope he does well. I hope he gets some good results on the Repsol bike. And you'd like to think that fast forward to 2021, he's going to be on some pretty good kit within the LCR team.
I suppose if Alex Marquez puts a positive spin on it, at least he can say, oh, well, I couldn't have done anything. I could not have done anything. This is not based on my poor performances on track, for example, because he hasn't had any. He hasn't even had a race, has he? So I suppose at least in the back of his mind, he can park that there and think, oh, well, it is what it is.
But then playing devil's advocate, why are they even considering getting rid of him when they haven't seen him race?
Well, indeed, yeah, which that's what makes me think perhaps that was part of the plan anyway, unless Paul Espargaro was just too good to turn down, I don't know.
Yeah, unless they've saw the data from Alex from, the tests he did do and sort of thinks, he's got a long way to go to sort of get the best out of our bike. But that's a harsh line, really, given that he had two tests on the bike, to make the transition. But like you say, it might just be what they've seen from Paul and they think he absolutely is the future and he can be a brilliant number two to Mark. I don't know, because as good as Mark is, there's always that sort of slight question mark over whether he can stay fully fit for a year given the amount of crashes he has. Obviously he has largely got away with them, crashes very little in races, which is incredible, but he does still jump off his bike quite often and he genuinely does get away with it, and he's obviously incredibly fit, incredibly flexible. He obviously spends a lot of time stretching, yoga, etc, which is why he sort of bounces so well, but he's also not as young as he was, so all these things do make him probably a slight risk, in which case you need another guy. Honda don't want to stop their winning ways, and maybe they just thought, we need another guy. We need someone else that could take over and take points off. Because that's the other thing as well is, how many points, even if Mark has any problems, how many points is Alex going to take away from someone like Dovi or Vinales or Quartararo or Valentino Rossi?
Yeah.
Realistically, he's not. So, there's I'm sure there has been quite a lot of debate and some decision making over this over the last few weeks.
I think you're completely right there. I think you've hit the nail on the head in the sense that Repsol Honda know if anything does happen to Marc Marquez, if he falls ill, if he gets hurt, if he can't race for any reason, there is absolutely no guarantee that Alex would just suddenly then slot into that leading position. It's a little bit like, I think, when Tom Sykes left Kawasaki and they brought Alex Lowes in, and it's motorcycle racing, you never know what's going to happen. But with the way things are at the moment, what we saw in Australia, it looks as though, if Jonathan Rea is not at the front, if he has a problem in one race, they can pretty much assume that Alex Lowes will be there or thereabouts. Whereas with Alex Marquez in his first season, he probably wasn't going to be right at the front, was he? I guess that's the risk.
Yeah, absolutely. And the tendency Mark has to crash.
Yeah,
which can happen, pushing the limits, you know, to such a degree. So, yeah, it's going to be, I think the great thing is, you know, obviously 2020 season has clearly been disrupted, but we're about to get underway. I still think it's going to be an amazing spectacle because the anticipation is going to be so high. And we already know 2021 is going to be good because we've got, you know, there's obviously, that's not the only change. You know, you've got Quartararo on a factory bike. We still don't know really what's happening at Ducati. There's talk even of Lorenzo coming back. I mean, not really so sure about that one, but you know, there's already change ahead for 2021 and we haven't even started 2020 yet. So, it's going to be good.
Just to complete that silly season conversation, what's happening with Dovi? Because the general feeling is he wants more money, but they want to pay him less at Ducati. Petrucci's gone to Tech3 KTM, the satellite team, not the factory team. Why is that? And then, of course, are we going to have Rossi Lorenzo teammates? I know you've just mentioned it there with Petronas. It's not out of the question. But Rossi will be on a Petronas bike next year, won't he? He's not going anywhere.
I believe so, yeah.
Surely.
Unless he's, you know, woefully uncompetitive at the first couple of rounds at Jerez, which I genuinely don't think he will be because he's obviously strong there. And I think Petronas, I think that deal almost needs to get wrapped up long before then anyway. I think that's kind of imminent, really. Dovi and Ducati, I think it's a strange one. You know, there's no question that Ducati's, you know, profit and loss account at the end of the year. You know, they're a manufacturer. They sell motorbikes largely, you know, not only do they build very good motorbikes, but they sell them on the back of their racing activities in MotoGP, WSB, BSB. You know, they will not sell as many motorbikes this year. They will not make as many motorbikes this year. They will therefore make less money this year. So that obviously will be the reasoning they're looking at in terms of paying less money for Dovi. I think the question you've got is where else will Dovi go, really?
Yeah, indeed.
That's almost, it's as coming back to Manuel, the Spanish journalist who's been around a long time, he just described it as a loveless marriage, the Ducati-Dovi partnership, which I think is probably quite true, or a marriage of convenience. you know, they're both together. They obviously perform well. But there doesn't seem to be much love lost between Dovi and, you know, project leader Gigi Deligna. But ultimately, you know, he's finished second the last 3 years. He'd be three-time world, you know, ifs and buts. But if Marc Marquez wasn't around, he'd be three-time world MotoGP champion. And we'd all look at Dovi in a very different light. Personally, I do think he's underrated. I think he's an incredibly clever and capable rider, and in many ways he's unfortunate to be racing at a time of Marc Marquez, but you know, there's plenty of racers that have got that story, you know, all the races through the 90s and the races through the noughties with Rossi, and you know, races in the 90s when Fogarty was ruling WSB. You know, you wouldn't want him to be a WSB rider then, you know, it took some pretty special people to beat him. So, but the trouble is you know, Yamaha are sewn up, KTM are sewn up, Suzuki are sewn up. Where could Dovi actually go? That's the question. I think for me, it's more, would he consider retiring? But I don't think he's going to do that either. So my gut feeling is it will see Dovi on the Ducati in 2021.
His outgoing teammate, Danilo Petrucci, there were a few rumours about him coming back to the World Superbike paddock. And you can imagine those rumours where they came from because he was in the World Superbike paddock before in Superstock 1000. He's on a Tech 3 KTM, Michael, not the KTM factory bike. Is that pretty much going to be a factory bike anyway? I mean, is that a downward step for him coming from a factory Ducati, or was it just a move across, a sideways move?
Well, no, I think you have to say that it's a downward step. You've gone from a factory Ducati, a bike that's absolutely at the front of MotoGP, to a manufacturer that is getting there quickly, but you know, being honest, you're not a top MotoGP manufacturer as we speak, and you're going into a satellite team within that. Saying that, I think that the KTM satellite team and the MotoGP and the factory team, I think, are very, very close. I think that is absolutely a project where everyone is putting everything to it to get the best result and to make the progress of the whole thing, you know, speed up as much as possible. I think I'll be honest, I was expecting him to go. I just presumed he was factory team. That was absolutely my assumption. I'm guessing he must have some pretty cast iron guarantees that he's going to be on the same level of equipment as Binder and Oliveira.
So in the same way Valentino Rossi would, if he goes Petronas, it might be a Petronas spike, but it's going to be the same, basically.
But whenever they say that, it's never quite the same.
No, it can't
be,
can it?
It might be a week or two behind. Mm. But I think Danilo could be really good for KTM. I think he's still motivated and we've seen how good he can be. He's just a bit kind of up and down, really. You know, he sort of had moments where you thought he really could be a man sort of breaking through. And then the next thing you know, he's sort of finishing outside the top 10 and not really delivering the results week in, week out, which obviously is not really what anyone wants. That's going to be an interesting one, you know. Binder and Oliveira, you know, Binder obviously a MotoGP rookie. Oliveira's got 1 year. I've personally always really rated Oliveira. I thought the way he goes about his racing, I thought he was such a clever Moto2 rider and really, really capable. So I'm actually really looking forward to how those guys progress. I think, you know, as a manufacturer, KTM are going to, you know, they're going to, because they're currently behind, I think they're gonna be progressing quicker than the other manufacturers, albeit they've still got a gap to close. But I sort of think, you know, 2020, I think you've got to, you know, not expect too much. 2021, expect more. But you know, that's a young team. And if you think you fast forward to sort of 2022, how good's that KTM going to be by then? How good are Oliveira and Binder going to be with a couple of years experience under their belt? You know, they could literally be, you know, they could be right up there. So I don't think it's a bad move, but saying all that, I think it's a real loss to KTM to lose Pol, because I think, as we said earlier, Pol was a rider that absolutely was prepared to get stuck in and get on with it, and even if things weren't going that great, he'd knuckle down and crack on. And I think that's a real skill and a real talent to have, you know, sort of mental strength to have when you're on a bike that isn't the best on the grid and you know you're up against it. But, you know, it's kind of, you also see the same with Alesh at Aprilia. You know, he never gives up. He always gives it 100%. They've obviously got good work ethic, the Espargaro brothers.
Yeah, the benchmark brothers. Michael, obviously it's Thursday as we chat now, but this, of course, has gone out on Monday. 2 days from now, Wednesday, MCN goes out. What can we look forward to in the sports section this week?
So it's going to be coverage from the World Superbike Test, which I'm really looking forward to that copy. I've got some good people on the ground there. We've got some sort of carrying on sort of nostalgia theme. We've got a look back at all the sort of most successful father and son in racing. And there'll be some obvious ones, you know, your Rossies, etc., but also some other ones which will be a good trip down memory lane, you know, from Johnny Ray and John's father, you know, Isle of Man TT winner, and the list goes on and on and on. And we've also got a tech analysis from Matt Oxley. We've also got Freddie TT fans as well. We've got a really nice piece on the 1992 senior, which was, of course, arguably the greatest ever senior TT, where Steve Hislop and Carl Fogarty went head to head on the Yamaha and a Norton. Real sort of really nice, actually, a real behind the scenes look at all the events actually led to what was ultimately a fantastic race, but with riders swapping bikes and deals being done. So it's a really, really, really nice insight, and gave us a good excuse to sort of trawl through the archives at MCN for all the old images, which is always, apart from you can lose a lot of time there, as you can probably appreciate, always quite a nice thing to be involved with.
I can hear James Whittam's voice in my head right now describing that TT 1992. And of course, I look forward to my signed Michael Guy copy of the paper hitting my front doormat on Wednesday morning.
Absolutely. I personally delivered, Greg, as always.
Yeah.
Many thanks from all of us here at Full Throttle to Michael Guy. And unfortunately, now we have to end the podcast on a rather sad note, because since the last show went out 2 weeks ago, we've had not one, but I'm afraid two tragic losses in the world of motorcycle racing. 25-year-old Ben Godfrey, we lost him just over a week ago when he was involved in a tragic accident, a track day accident at Donington Park, when he ran into the back of another rider on the start-finish straight. A tragic, tragic piece of news to hear that Ben lost his life in that accident. He was racing in the National Pirelli Superstock 1000 Championship alongside BSP last year, and this year was actually set to be lining up on the grid in the Ducati Performance Tri-Options Cup. Now, the man who oversees the cup as the ambassador to the series is the 2009 British Supersport champion, Steve Plater.
Ben Godfrey, yeah, a great lad. So enthusiastic about racing, you know, very passionate, always had a big smile on his face, you know, a lot of friends in the paddock. I spent quite a lot of time with Ben, you know, when he was riding for the IMR team in National Superstock Fail Championship, walking tracks and doing various things. He's always trying to better himself, you know, and luckily I managed to time in with a ride with Pete Hassler's team in the Ducati Tri-Options Cup for 2020, and most of the other competitors were quite scared he was going to be pretty formidable in the championship this year.
Thank you very much indeed there to Steve Plater. Some words there on Ben Godfrey, who sadly lost his life just over a week ago in an accident at Donington Park. More sad news as well, unfortunately, in the motorcycle racing world. In the middle of June, Pauline Hailwood, the widow of Mike the Bike Hailwood, absolute legend, of course, in the 1960s, has passed away. Pauline had been battling cancer for a number of years, and we sadly lost her in the middle of June. And with memories of Pauline Hailwood on the line now, we have a good friend of mine and former MotoGP commentator on the world feed, Nick Harris. It was a pleasure to work alongside Nick in 2014, and one of the best memories with you, Nick, was when we used to talk about Mike Hailwood. I remember a particularly amusing time in Texas when we talked about Mike the Bike himself. And I know you got to know Pauline quite well in recent years, actually. So terrible news to hear of Pauline's loss, Nick.
Well, as you know, Greg, Mike Hailwood was my sporting hero, certainly when I was growing up. More a fan than a journalist. He came from my part of the world. He lived, what, a couple of miles from where I'm talking just this moment. His dad ran Kings of Oxford, the famous motorcycle business. So I was a massive fan. Pauline, his wife, I'll be honest with you, I didn't know, but I got to know, sadly, after Mike's death, when he was inducted into the MotoGP Hall of Fame at the British Grand Prix at Donington Park. I hosted the induction and I met Pauline and his son, David. What an amazing lady to live through what had happened, of course, in 1981, the car crash when Mike had finished racing, that he lost both his daughter, Mikael, and his own life in a car crash when he was just going to pick up the family fish and chips on a Saturday night. An accident was absolutely not his fault. So a very, very brave lady indeed.
And as you say, Nick, it's been obviously years since we lost Mike in 1981 in that tragic car accident in Warwickshire. But, you know, in the time you've got to know Pauline, I suppose you must have heard a few stories, actually, from Pauline.
She told me lots of stories. The story that really stuck in my mind, she said when he was driving a Formula One car in 1973, if you remember, there was a terrible crash in Kyalami in South Africa, and Mike Hailwood, despite his overalls being on fire, pulled out Clay Regazzoni out of a burning car. And for that act of heroism, he did receive the George Medal, which is the highest accolade I think you can get, certainly in England, apart from in wartime. So an amazing bravery record. But she told me when he came back to the pits after all that had happened, he never even told anybody, certainly didn't tell her, that he'd pulled a competitor out of a burning car and saved his life. And to me, that summed it up. Very, very sad news about Pauline Hailwood. I'm sure she never fully recovered from losing her daughter and her husband in that car crash. But what some memories for her of a truly remarkable man.
Well, Nick, in your own words, thank you very much indeed. Nick Harris there with some words on the late Pauline Hailwood. We will be back with the Full Throttle podcast here on Eurosport on Monday, the 13th of July, as we get closer and closer to the resumption of racing, starting with World Superbikes, of course, in Jerez in Spain, the south of Spain, Andalusia, the boiling hot track, as it will be there on the first weekend of August. If you have enjoyed the show, please take the time to subscribe if you can. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts. You can find us on the Eurosport website as well and other good podcast suppliers. But thank you very much indeed for listening. Thank you especially to Michael Guy for the interview earlier on in the show. But sadly, at the end of this week's Full Throttle, we are mourning the loss of not one, but two motorcycle racing names, Pauline Hailwood and Ben Godfrey.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.